KYW News Radio Original Podcasts.
The Week in Philly on KYW News Radio is recorded and edited every Friday afternoon. For the latest updates to any of the stories you're about to hear, listen to KYW News Radio anytime on your smart speaker or the Odyssey or iHeartRadio apps. Visit KYWNewsRadio.com or follow us on social media at KYW News Radio.
This is The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
Welcome to our weekly look at the stories that have been making headlines in Philadelphia and the region. My name is Matt Leon, and over the next hour, we will bring in KYW News Radio reporters to break down the stories you have been talking about. The School District of Philadelphia's facilities plan is approved by the school board.
It was 6-3 in favor of the superintendent's plan.
Mike DiNardo will have all the details. The Phillies' rotten start to the season cost manager Rob Thompson his job.
If the team's not going to play well on the field, unfortunately the fall guy is going to be the manager.
Dave Uram will have that story. Quakertown community members continue to demand answers in the aftermath of a February anti-ICE protest that went viral.
It wasn't touched on in the meeting at all.
Vic Raghupathy will have more. Then Pat Loeb gets us ready for the quickly approaching Pennsylvania primary elections on May 19th.
I think it's all about turnout.
Connor Barcon will tell us how the last month of wildly fluctuating temperatures have really hurt local farmers.
We really can't stress this enough. This is a very big deal.
And then Sonny Morgan tells us about a plan to try and revitalize the Market East corridor.
Six local businesses are given the opportunity to host pop-up shops in these spaces on that block.
All that is ahead over the next hour. I hope you'll join us for The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, and we will get started right after this.
Six yeses, three noes.
We start this edition of The Week in Philly talking schools. On Thursday night, the Philadelphia School Board approved the district's long-debated facilities plan. The headline of that plan, of course, the closure of 17 schools. For more on this, let's bring in KYW's Mike DiNardo. And Mike, we thought this was going to happen a week ago, but the school board punted it to Thursday when they finally voted.
Yeah, you'll remember Superintendent Tony Watlington modified the plan the Monday before last, taking Ludlow Elementary off the closure list. And the school board at the time set a vote on the plan for that Thursday, 3 days later. Now, city council members cried foul, saying the vote was being rushed and they wanted more time. The board, about 2 hours before that scheduled vote on the 23rd, punted the votes to this past Thursday, the 30th.
Now, before the vote, members of city council, they really did lean in to try to delay this. What happened?
Oh, yeah. In the morning of Thursday, many city council members opposed to the closure plan, led by Education Committee Chair Isaiah Thomas and council member Jamie Gaudier. They rallied outside Paul Robeson High School in University City. That's one of the schools slated to close. Now, Thomas vowed to create civil disobedience to prevent the vote. And Thursday night, that's what happened. Board President Reginald Streeter recessed the meeting for 20 minutes. Now, when the board meeting resumed, and as it appeared the plan had enough votes to pass, Thomas began shouting again.
Go vote for it. Just vote for it. So we can call for your resignation. Vote for it and it's your last vote.
And that's when Streeter declared a second recess. And the nine board members took an extraordinary step. They left the boardroom and they went into their offices, signing onto Zoom, and they took the official vote there online.
And how did the vote break down?
It was a 6-3 vote with board president Reginald Streeter, VP Sarah Ashley Andrews, Cheryl Harper, Chow-Wing Lam, Joan Stern, and Voice Wilkerson voting in favor. Crystal Cubbage, Whitney Jones, and Wanda Novalis voted no. Those for the plan said the status quo wasn't working and something had to be done with the district's aging facilities. Those opposed questioned whether it would really improve academics, and they also questioned the district's ability to pay for it.
And we should talk about, because when we reference this, we almost always say closing X amount of schools and it ended up being 17. But there's a lot more to it, there is stuff that is kind of in the positive direction as well that doesn't get the headlines, right?
Yeah, it would see building improvements to 169 schools over the 10 years. It would see a new high school built for Benjamin Rush. It would see resources for algebra for all middle school students. That's something that there isn't right now. And more AP offerings at high schools. The plan concentrates more resources in neighborhood high schools and moves away from smaller specialized high schools, including Lankinaw Environmental and Paul Robeson, which council members were trying to save.
Now, council does not have a direct role in this, city council, but there was obviously blowback, and you talk about the intensity at the meeting. Could they make life miserable for the school board going forward?
No doubt. As you say, council doesn't get a direct say on the facilities plan, but they do hold the purse strings. They're considering the mayor's rideshare tax to fund schools, and members are essentially saying to the school district, why should we give you more money when you're closing schools in our districts? There's also talk that council would block the reappointments of school board members who supported the plan. A reminder, board members' terms come up every 4 years with the mayor's term. The mayor appoints them and council has to confirm them. And another reminder, Matt, members of the school board are volunteers. They do not get paid.
So the board approves the plan. What's next?
Well, conceivably, the plan could still change. There is a state-mandated process to close a school that involves public hearings. And in any case, schools won't be closing right away under the plan. Any closures wouldn't happen until the fall of 2027. And there would be what the district calls a planning year between now and then. But staff and communities at individual schools, Matt, are still vowing to fight these closures by any means necessary.
All right, Mike, thank you very much. KYW's Mike DiNardo joining us, and we are just getting started on this edition of The Week in Philly. Coming up, the Phillies make a big change, and Dave Uram will have all the details. Don't go anywhere.
When you're not playing well and you're the manager of a ball club, you're held accountable, and rightly so.
We continue on this edition of The Week in Philly, and the Phillies had an absolutely terrible start to the season, and that led to a big change this week as manager Rob Thompson was fired on Tuesday. He was replaced on an interim basis by Don Mattingly, who had been serving as the Phil's bench coach, and for more on this, let's bring in KYW's Dave Uram. And Dave, as the losses piled up here, you got the feeling something had to give, and usually if you follow baseball, you know the manager getting pushed out is the first button used.
And that's unfortunate because, you know, Rob Thompson is a very good guy, and he's had a lot of success in terms of regular season wins and a couple of nice postseason runs with the Phillies, Matt. And it was just a shame that his tenure as the manager came to an end like this. I'm not saying that Rob didn't make any mistakes along the way. Of course, Rob made some mistakes along the way. Nobody's going to be perfect. But as a lot of the players alluded to the day that he got fired, if the team's not going to play well on the field for whatever reason, and the team was not playing well, unfortunately, the fall guy is going to be the manager. And that was the case with Rob Thompson.
But despite his tenure coming to an end, I think when you look at it in totality, Rob Thompson will go down as one of the greatest managers in Phillies history. I mean, for my money, I think Charlie Manuel is number one. Rob Thompson's in the discussion for number two.
Yeah, Matt. I mean, four postseason appearances in a row, back-to-back division championships, a National League pennant. That is success. That is very good success. It's unfortunate that they did not go all the way. And Rob, to his credit, is very accountable and would be the first one to tell you that they should have won a World Series and they didn't get the job done.
Now, to that point, Rob Thompson did what is a rare thing after the movie. He held his own Zoom to kind of talk about the decision. And as anyone who has been paying attention the last several years would expect, he really, truly handled everything with class.
Absolutely, 100%. It's not common when a head coach or a manager gets fired to be doing a press availability with the media that same very day, or really at all. And not only that, this was done through the Phillies.
I wanted to do this before I bounced out of town, and I wanted to get my face in front of everybody and answer the questions.
And it speaks to the type of man that Rob Thompson is. He's wonderful. He was really good with the media. You know, he said he had no ill will towards Dave Dombrowski, towards John Middleton. He said his relationship with them is rock solid. You know, he believes that this ball club can turn it around. In this video conference, you know, he just got fired earlier in the day, and he was talking like he was still a member of the Phillies. He was saying words like our game.
Hey, let's go to Matt Gelb.
What are you going to do tonight?
I might watch some hockey playoffs tonight, but actually I'm going to watch our game.
He was talking like he was still the Phillies because in retrospect, yeah, he's a Philly for life for the things that he accomplished here. He did not rule out potentially coming back down the road, staying with the organization in a different capacity. He did not rule that out. And, you know, this is a guy who's been in professional baseball for over 40 years. So I asked Rob, I said, of your 40-plus years in baseball, where does the 8 to 9 years in Philadelphia rank for you? And he ranked it right at the top.
This has been the most fun that I've had in baseball the last 4 years.
So, you know, his nickname is Philly Rob, and he will always, regardless of how things ended, regardless of the fact that he didn't win a World Series, he will always, always be Philly Rob.
So Don Mattingly, who is now the interim manager, of course, most people remember him as a Yankee legend, as a player, as a long managerial resume with the Marlins and the Dodgers. Now, I saw an interview with him prior to the season, and he said he really had no interest in managing again, but here we are.
Yeah. Yeah, he indicated once he became the interim manager that was really kind of because Rob Thompson was there, and it was out of respect to Rob Thompson. But he indicated that he has energy. You know, he mentioned beforehand about he really had no interest in talking to the media as much as a manager does. Well, his second day on the job, he held a 17-minute or so pregame press conference, kind of a get-to-know-you type of thing with Don Mattingly. So he is very 2 feet in with this job right now.
Do you think if the Phillies improve, could he get this long-term?
I think it's hard to say. It's hard to predict. As of right now, he's the interim manager through the rest of this season. So I don't know. If I had to take a prediction, I'm going to say no, just because of everything that he has said before and where he is in his life. He has a young son. So I would probably say no, but you never know what can happen.
And should things not turn around, I don't think Don Mattingly is going anywhere in the short term, but do you think we see other changes? Because there's a whole lot of money poured into this team, and if they play this badly for another couple months, they're going to lose a lot of the fan base.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, you know, they have so many expensive contracts. Those are hard to move, Matt. Those are really hard to move. I don't know. That's a great question, but I don't know the answer to that. I mean, usually when things go wrong, changes happen. I just don't know exactly what they would be.
All right, thank you very much, Dave. KYW's Dave Uram joining us. We need to step away. We've still got a lot to get to on this edition of The Week in Philly, and we will do just that right after this.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer,
SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait. There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today, and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino
and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's The Week in Philly, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love.
How many calories? What do you say?
How many kids did you choke today?
How many kids did you choke today?
Welcome back to The Week in Philly. And this week, a borough council meeting in Quakertown was the platform for residents to air their frustrations after a peer investigation into a February 20th anti-ICE protest cleared Quakertown Police Chief Scott McElry of any wrongdoing. Now, if you remember, videos of the protest showed McElry in plain clothes, he never identified himself, putting a teenage ICE protester in a chokehold. Five kids were arrested, and there were lots of questions about what happened in the aftermath. KYW's Vic Raghupathy has been covering this story and attended this week's council meeting. And Vic, tell us more about this investigation. Who conducted it, and what did it say?
Right, so this was a panel of four Bucks County police chiefs. So people who essentially have the same position as McElry. It was called a peer review investigation. Essentially, what they're doing is assessing, based on their police backgrounds, the merits of sort of McElry's police report, whether Quakertown police did all they could, and McElry in particular did all he could to keep the situation safe and to respond in the right way. And they found a few things. They found one that, you know, they said that McElry, you know, used force appropriately. And they mentioned, you know, some minor injuries to the students involved. But they also said in their report that injuries sustained is not necessarily an indicator of whether a police officer is using force appropriately, that it depends more on the context. And honestly, reading through the report, what stuck out to me was that it looked like they gave more weight or more credence to the injuries that McElry sustained, kind of downplayed the, you know, any injuries that were sustained by the other kids. They also, the panel commended Quakertown police for their flexibility and said that they were well prepared. They only really gave a couple recommendations, one being that McElry needs to, in the future, identify himself better, either by wearing a badge or just by verbally saying. And I believe that he's claimed that he did identify himself, but a lot of other people involved in the situation have said that it was not clear who he was and the kids didn't know who he was. And they also recommended that officers involved in this should be wearing body cameras.
This borough council meeting where we heard the backlash in response to the investigation, and it sounds like, listening to your reports, folks from Quakertown, the people that spoke out, weren't too happy with what this investigation kind of laid out there?
I think there are a couple reasons that they're angry. One is the findings of this investigation, and a few of the people I talked to are saying, like, well, this appears to be just police covering for police.
It's the equivalent of having your mom be your reference for a job interview. It makes no sense.
One person put it as sanitizing police action as opposed to truly examining it. And then the other thing is there is an ongoing investigation being done by the Bucks County DA's office and Bucks County DA Joe Kahn. Residents are also frustrated that this investigation has either progressed slowly or there hasn't been enough information divulged to the public. They want more transparency and accountability.
Our community deserves a truly independent review with the full public transparency, civilian oversight, and accountability grounded in facts, not institutional bias.
I think a lot of them just feel like it's trying to be swept under the rug more than anything. And Monday night's meeting wasn't even pertaining to this, really. It was just a borough council work meeting. I think what they're really trying to do is just make sure that it doesn't leave people's consciousness. I think in their minds, the officials in charge of either investigating or addressing this somehow while McElry is on leave are kind of just hoping it goes away.
People that are violent towards children do not deserve positions of power.
Yes.
Did anyone in council have anything to say? Or I would imagine they probably deferred to the Bucks County DA investigating this.
That's essentially, there is, I think the person who was leading the meeting addressed the issue briefly right at the beginning, essentially just to say, yes, that it's being investigated by Bucks County DA Joe Kahn, and also essentially that they weren't going to address it further. And it wasn't touched on in the meeting at all by any of the council members beyond that, other than them sitting and listening to, you know, a handful of community members get up and talk.
And do we have any idea how long the investigation by the Bucks County DA is going to take, like any timeline, the status of it, anything like that?
Frankly, we haven't gotten a timeline and we haven't received any updates really from them. You know, at this point, it's 2 months on, more than 2 months on from the incident itself. And I think people are getting a little frustrated that there hasn't been any progress or even any or much, you know, lip service to the issue.
All right, thank you very much, Vic. That's KYW's Vic Ragyapathy joining us. Need to step away. We'll have more on this edition of The Week in Philly coming up right after this.
They all agree. I liked all their ideas.
It's about choosing someone who knows how to get things done. That's why I'm in.
Philly Dems values are similar.
We got to tax the rich.
I haven't made up my mind yet.
When government systems failed, I stepped up.
This is the week in Philly, and the Pennsylvania primary elections are coming up in a couple of weeks, May 19th to be exact, and we wanted to take a look at things. So for more, let's bring in KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb. And Pat, first off, we should note before we talk about any races or anything that while the primary is still a couple of weeks away, the deadline to register to vote in the primary election, it's just about here, right?
Yes, Monday is the last day to register for the primary.
Now, the focus in the city, I think, for the primary will be the race to replace Dwight Evans in Congress. And really, it has turned into quite the race in the Democratic primary. Break down who is running here.
Well, the race started with 12 candidates. 11 actually petitioned to get on the ballot. But there were really only five people considered serious candidates because they were out there fundraising and campaigning. But two of them have now dropped out. So we are down to three. State Senator Sharif Street, State Representative Chris Robb, and Dr. Ayla Stamford. Street, scion of a political family, Robb, a progressive firebrand, and Stamford, founder of the Black Doctors Consortium, which made testing and vaccines widely available in vulnerable communities during the COVID pandemic.
Now, one of the things that has fascinated me is who has gotten endorsed by who. Take us inside here and how the factions have kind of broken off.
Yes, well, Street, insider, well-connected, so perhaps not surprisingly, he's got the backing of Labor, the Democratic City Committee, Black clergy, the mayor, and several city council members and fellow legislators. He's kind of running the board. But Robb appeals to the progressive left, which has shown itself to be very engaged and committed. So he has the backing of Reclaim, 1PA, Working Families, and even Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is a party star and endorsed in only two other races. And he has the progressive congressional PAC spending on his behalf. And then Stamford has Dwight Evans' endorsement. He wants her to succeed him. She's also endorsed by her would-be colleagues, Madeline Dean and Chrissy Houlihan. And one of the other serious candidates who dropped out, Dr. David Oxman, not only endorsed her, but asked his donors to move their money to her. He thinks it's very important to have a doctor in Congress right now. Plus, Stamford has two big PACs behind her, Emily's List and the ProScience 314 Project.
Do you feel there is a prohibitive favorite at this point, given all that endorsement news, or is it a slight favorite? How would you kind of look at things right now?
I think it's all about turnout. If this becomes a committeeman's election where only the party faithful turn out, you'd have to call Sharif Street the front runner. Now, in a midterm primary where there is really only this contested race, I mean, there are a lot of important offices on the ballot, but incumbents are running mostly unopposed. It's up to the voters to show up and upset the race or stay home and just kind of let things happen the way they happen.
And we should point out, like a lot of races that are kind of based in Philadelphia, this is really the election here. Whoever wins the Democratic primary is an almost certain to win in November, correct?
Oh, this is the bluest congressional district in the country. Yes, the winner of the Democratic primary will probably run unopposed in November.
Now, you also did a story this week talking about voting. City commissioners want to get the word out about mail-in ballots. Specifically, what did they want to focus on?
They want you to know they've taken steps to give the city the greatest voting accessibility in the country. They have 11 satellite offices, one in each council district and one at City Hall, where you can go and register, ask for a mail-in ballot, fill it out, and return it all at the same time. And they're open 7 days a week.
Looking past 2026 to 2028, Philadelphia is in play to perhaps host the 2028 Democratic National Convention. The city hosted it in 2016. They've hosted it prior to that. What is it about Philadelphia that the DNC, the people of the Democratic Party, like? And how realistic is this that this could happen?
Well, Philadelphia has excellent facilities. They have the Xfinity Mobile Arena and the Convention Center, which served quite well in 2016 and since then have been upgraded. There's been hundreds of millions of dollars of improvements in both locations. And they are used to big events. Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, and Denver are the other four cities in the running. The host committee brought back the former ambassador, David Cohen, who helped land the 2016 convention. One thing that Cohen noted about Philadelphia is it's in a purple state.
Thank you very much, Pat. KYW City Hall Bureau Chief Pat Loeb joining us. More to get to on this edition of The Week in Philly, and we will bring it to you right after this. The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio is sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Now's the time for a great deal on a new Honda. It's time to drive smarter with high-tech features and excellent reliability. It's time for intelligent design plus exciting performance. Get a new vehicle you'll love. Check out the Honda Civic, Accord, or HR-V. See dealer for financing details. This is The Week in Philly, and the weather has been all over the place over the last month or so. I know I myself, I've never toggled between running the heat and running the air conditioning in our house as much as I have over the last few weeks. Now, one of the extremes of our recent weather situation saw us get a pretty late frost, and that really hurt local farmers. For more, let's bring in KYW's Connor Barkon. And Connor, you spoke with folks at a farm in Westchester. Talk about what they've had to deal with.
That's right, Matt. I met with Maxwell Cohen, who is the agricultural director of Farmer John in Westchester. Farmer John grows organic, fresh produce, and they have a market right next to the farm. That's on 926 there. Cohen loves what he does, but he says peaks and valleys and hot and cold conditions are increasing labor hours on the farm.
I've had crops get really happy and big. We have this cold freeze come on, and now it's kind of shocked them at a stage of their life where you really don't want to have those sort of weather patterns.
And Cohen says that means the cost of local produce will likely increase, and of course the inventory could also fluctuate.
How does this affect this farm's outlook for the rest of the year as far as can they still make money? Are they still going to be able to bring everything they want to consumers? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, so a couple things here. I mean, the weather itself is to blame for Farmer John's late opening. Again, they have the market on 926. They bring the produce in just down the road. That's going to open later. That's a direct result of the weather. Now, consumers have gotten used to expecting certain things at certain times of the year, even when they're not necessarily in season. But adaptations have had to be made this year, and that means that consumers should expect some different some variations on the shelves. Produce may not be there at the times of year when they expect.
Now, and to that point, you focused on one or two farms for this story, but I know I live in South Jersey. One place lost their entire cherry crop. That was the pick your own cherry, so that's gone. Other places I know have lost parts of their peach and apple orchards. Like, this is everyone for the most part. If you have a medium to large scale farm and it's your livelihood, you've probably lost something and or had to take extreme measures to maintain what you have, no?
Yeah. At many farms in our area, many orchards in our area. And, you know, there's a report of a winery in South Jersey that, you know, all the grapes are frozen. And they won't know until a few weeks from now whether or not they lost everything. So it's important to talk about the profit margin that farmers have. It's very razor thin. They don't make a lot of money to begin with. So when a crop is wiped out, that's devastating. That's a devastating blow. And you're talking about a crop that's had a lot of time and a lot of labor that's been invested into it.
And you talk about those profit margins, and farmers also are dealing with higher fuel prices because of what's happening with the war in Iran and the Strait of Hormuz being closed. Also, that is directly affecting fertilizer prices. So farmers have to deal with probably at best higher prices from multiple inputs. Maybe at worst, they're going to hit a point where they might not be able to start getting things. And you put on top of that, oh, by the way, it was 90 degrees on Monday and 27 on Thursday. Have fun. Like, this is an awful lot to deal with.
Yeah, we really can't stress this enough. This is a very big deal. I mean, you're talking about a devastating blow. You're talking about their livelihood and their business. I don't mean to speak in generalities, but the farmers that I've spoken to are all very good people. And they care a lot about their business. They care a lot about their employees. I spoke with Dawn Zimmerman, who's the owner of Ethel's Backyard, which is a flower farm in Westchester. And she said that she would do anything in her power, making sacrifices herself rather than to pass any profit loss onto her employees. And, you know, for what it's worth, for flower farmers, this happened at the worst time of year for them.
And it's wedding season for us. And that's huge. Mother's Day, Easter, flower farmers make money in the spring.
And we have gotten so spoiled and by we, I mean Americans, just having just about anything we wanted available at any time. And going through this, that thing that you've taken for granted might not be there anymore. And then even if it is there, stuff is going to be more expensive and everybody is going to feel this. So this is not just a story that focuses on hard luck for farmers. The ripple effects eventually touch all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you may hear people talk about it. Oh, it's been a bad year for peppers this year, and that's why they're expensive and small. I think it would benefit consumers just in general, not just because of the frost, to be a little bit more adaptable. You know, to eat food that's fresh rather than to just follow a recipe. Oh, I got to get a tomato because it says that there's a tomato, and even though it's not in season. I mean, I think it would benefit everybody to sort of change their mindset when it comes to how they buy their produce.
And not for nothing, and I don't want to equate my fun little patch in the backyard to these people who base their livelihood on it, but I do enjoy gardening, growing vegetables, and that frost cost me some potatoes, cost me some corn, but it came after a week of like in the 80s where you are so anxious to get out and enjoy it that you're going to jump the gun, and then this smacks the feet out from under you.
Yeah. I mean, you and I garden, we talk about it. And yeah, I mean, I remember weeks ago thinking, oh, I can't wait to get my tomatoes in the ground this this weekend. And I had to pump the brakes on that. And my tomatoes have been in my garage looking at me funny, like, hey, you know, what's going on? Yeah, it's frustrating on a small scale. But you can imagine if that's your business, if that's your livelihood, and you just have this unpredictable weather, it's really, not only does it hurt you this year, but you may have to rethink the way you do your job and the way that generations have done your job.
All right. Thank you very much, Connor. That's KYW's Connor Barkon joining us. We need to take a break. More of this edition of The Week in Philly coming up right after this.
Expect coffee and water ice and records and arts and fashion. It's really going to allow Philadelphians to engage with each other in a slightly less just pure transactional way.
This is The Week in Philly, and this week we learned of work being done along East Market Street to try and revitalize that Market East corridor. For more on this, let's bring in KYW's Sonny Morgan, who covered this story this week. And first off, Sonny, where exactly are we talking about on Market Street?
So we're talking about the stretch of East Market Street between 9th and 10th, the 900 block. So there are some storefronts that have been vacant there for a while.
What will be happening on this stretch? What are they doing?
So yeah, since these storefronts have been vacant, there hasn't been obviously much activity over there right across from the Fashion District. So now six local businesses are given the opportunity to host pop-up shops in these spaces on that block.
Who is behind this? Like, what company or what organization is pushing this?
So it's a lot of different partnerships, but the anchor business or the anchor company that's helping is a nonprofit called Meantime. They focus on finding vacant properties in Philly and using them for events and experiences from local creatives and local entrepreneurs. They're working in partnership with the City of Philadelphia, Center City District, and the Fashion District. Also, Comcast and the Sixers ownership own a lot of those buildings on that block, so they're in partnership as well.
What kind of stores are we talking about? What kind of pop-up businesses could we be seeing?
So there's Sadiq's Water Ice from West Philly, Two Persons Coffee from the Bach Building, Almost Famous, which is sort of like a traveling vintage upcycle clothes company, Club Friends Radio and Records. They're selling vinyl records and hosting listening sessions. I actually got to try out one of the listening sessions the other day. Rarefy, they focus on rare and collectible furniture, and they'll have an exhibit on Philly's design history. And Art Philly will create a hub for artists and creators.
How long is this going to last?
The city says the pop-up will be open starting May 6th through July 31st.
So kind of take us through the bulk of the summer, I would assume, as everyone descends on Philadelphia for the semi-quincentennial.
Yeah, I think that's the goal, yeah.
So this is short term. Are there long term plans? Like, could, if this is successful, could it lead to something, or is that TBD?
I'd say TBD. The city, this is really all they've announced for this area so far. They also, the mayor did say they're going to host some sort of like open street party on that block of East Market. So a car free sort of celebration with DJs and things like that. But that's all they've said. So city officials say the Market East Revival and Advisory Group are going to hold focus groups and public discussions on what's next.
All right. Thank you very much, Sonny. That's KYW's Sonny Morgan joining us. And that's going to do it for this edition of The Week in Philly from KYW News Radio, sponsored by your Delaware Valley Honda dealers. Get a deal you'll like on a Honda you'll love. This week's episode was produced by Sabrina Boyd-Circa and Brian Seltzer. My name is Matt Leon. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your weekend.